And I was just saying to my wife today, I've been away in Durham preaching over the weekend, and I was just saying to her when I came back home, we were just talking about this passage that I'm going to be preaching on tonight. I was just saying to her that really, I have found my own heart tremendously strengthened and encouraged through preparing this message. I have to say that really honestly before God. The encouragement that I have drawn in my own heart and my own life from this chapter, I'd find it very hard to put into words. My own Christian faith has been really strengthened and fired by these amazing 14 verses. And I hope that they'll be etched on your memory forever and that you will never forget this message during your lifetime that you will hear tonight. Because I do believe it's a message for everybody. Boys and girls, young people, men and women, older people, whatever. You watching, listening, wherever you are. It is just one of those wonderful passages of Scripture that show us that God is involved with our lives and cares about us. We're reading in Esther chapter 6, I'm in the New King James. That night the king could not sleep. So one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus, that tried to assassinate him. Then the king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" And the king's servants who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." And the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. The king's servant said to him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king asked him, "What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?" Now Haman thought in his heart, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" And Haman answered the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought, which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on its head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor. Then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Then the king said to Haman, "Hasten, take the robe and the horse, as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew." Who sits within the king's gate. "Leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken." So Haman took the robe and the horse, a red Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square and proclaimed before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man who delights to honor, the king delights to honor." Afterwards, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hastened to his house, mourning and with his head covered. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him, his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him." While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. Now, let's have a wee preview of what's going to happen in chapter 9. In the 12th month, verse 1 of 9, the month of Adar on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command in his decree to be executed. On the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, the opposite occurred. In that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. The Jews gathered together in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who had sought their harm. And no one could withstand them. Now notice this wee phrase. Because fear of them fell upon all people. And all the officials of the provinces and satraps, the governors, and all those doing the king's work helped the Jews. Now this is the line. Because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. Got a hold of that wee phrase. For Mordecai was great in the king's palace. His fame spread throughout all the provinces. For this man, Mordecai, became increasingly prominent. Now, that's all we read. Let's go back to chapter 6. Most people in this world are in the pursuit of happiness. And of course, by nature, everybody seeks for happiness in this world and in the things of this world. The plain fact is that happiness cannot truly be found in the things of this world. True happiness cannot be found in the things of this world. Learn it, and it'll save you a lot of heartache. If you're sitting in this service tonight, watching me by video, listening by audio, and you are at enmity with God, my dear friend, you cannot be happy at enmity with God. All earthly enjoyments without God are ultimately empty. There is no real happiness either in this world or in the next, but by the favor of God. And if you're running from God tonight, then in God's presence in this Bible class, I appeal to you to return to God through Jesus Christ. Here's Mordecai, this amazing man. Let's not go back across the story because many of you have studied it in detail with me up until this point. Mordecai, with the threatening of death against him and the gallows erected the night before in preparation for his death, 75 feet high and ready to hang him on. With a whole nation before his eyes, from Ethiopia to India, with Jews scattered all over it, going to be slaughtered. It was going to be lawful to kill a Jew on a certain day 9 months ahead by the edict of the king. And yet, the plain fact of this passage is that this man, Mordecai, with even death hanging over his head and in the misery of his situation, was a far happier man in the confidence of divine providence and protection than Haman with all of the profusion of royal power that he had. Notice in chapter 5 again, how that he had gone back in verse 11, 5:11, just cast your eye down it. He had been telling his wife, 5:11, of his great riches. 5:11, his great riches, the multitude of his children, all the ways the king had promoted him, how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Moreover, he said, Queen Esther invited nobody but me to come in with the king to the banquet that she had prepared. And tomorrow I am invited with her along with the king. Yet all this avails me nothing, So long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate, Mordecai wouldn't bow down to him. And it didn't matter what promotion he had, it didn't matter what healthy children he had, it didn't matter what wealth he had, one single Jew not showing him what he thought was his due had made him disappointed. And how like people in the world tonight who seem to have everything but are ultimately miserably disappointed with their lot. In this world, the most successful ambition that you can have or achieve is always a disappointment as far as ultimate happiness is concerned. Whether you're a scholar, an academic, a great soldier, a great politician, a great writer, or whatever, if you gain the utmost prominence in our society, and you don't know God, this passage is teaching there is always something that makes disappointment prey on your soul. I don't know who's watching. I can't tell who's listening. Maybe somebody very prominent who got exactly what they went after. Ultimately, it is a disappointment if you don't know God. You see, it's a paradox. Is it not a paradox, everybody, that the people of God are frequently going through times of great sorrow and pressure, but can always rejoice? Though now, says the Bible, for a season they are in heaviness through manifold trials. And how many of the people of God across this province and across the world tonight have terrible sorrow in their lives and trials and pressure and difficulty that are great, yet these manifold trials, and they are in heaviness, even now, says Peter, you rejoice with joy unspeakable and full of glory. The people of God seem to be the weaklings and the minnows. And the big fish in this world that appear to be so successful and so ambitious and getting everything they seem to want, ultimately it's a disappointment and vanity and empty. And yet here are the people of God going through lots of trials, and yet at the same time they have a joy that they can hardly describe. It's a wonderful paradox that Christians experience. How can they endure? They endure as seeing Him who is invisible. It's like that verse about Moses, who would rather suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater than all the honors and the riches of Egypt. He looked an absolute fool with that bunch of grumbling people going through the wilderness, and yet at the same time that man was the wisest man that he could possibly be, esteeming the reproach of Christ far greater than all the riches that were in Egypt. It's a paradox. The raising of Mordecai to prominence is one of the most outstanding examples in all history of the truth that when everything seems lost, it isn't. There is no better example that I could find you in the Bible tonight to set up this great truth that when everything seems lost, that's the very time it isn't. Here is a nation, Israel, seems lost. Their future seems lost. Their hope seems lost. The sand in the hourglass of Israel's history seems to be rapidly running out in this part of the Persian Empire. Genocide stares them in the eyes 9 months down the road. Inevitable. And even if the king does pull back his edict, he hasn't got enough time to send horses far enough to reach the far end of his province to pull the edict back. He's not like Saddam Hussein, you know, with missiles 5 minutes away from Tel Aviv. Here is an absolutely seemingly impossible situation that God's people face. Yet, watch with me God's providential plan at work. Watch the searchlight of the sacred text here in this sixth chapter come round and pick out not Esther now, but Mordecai, her cousin who raised her, an amazing man. He proves not only that when all seems lost, it isn't, but that when nobody seems to notice, God does. Now, we've already discovered that Mordecai had earlier in the story discovered a couple of fellows who worked for the king, who tried and were planning to assassinate him. And he discovered the plot, and he told the plot to the authorities, and the king's life was spared. But why was he not rewarded immediately on the discovery of his good act? The smallest services to majesty usually meet an immediate recognition. I know a fellow here in Ulster who rushed to help a relation of the Queen's in an emergency. And I was in his house one day, and there was a beautiful picture of Her Majesty signed in the corner that she had sent to him. He had rushed to help her friend and relative. And she had recognized it and had invited him into her company. And he told me about it. He didn't save her. He tried to save her friend. And he was recognized. Any royal house around the world, of course, loves to do that within a nation. To honor good things within a country and good people and honorable actions. But why then? Why then wasn't this Jew rewarded for saving the life of this man who ruled the Persian Empire? Why was he overlooked? I'll tell you, not only was he overlooked, but it looked certainly very clear to me anyway, and to others, wouldn't you think, that he had been entirely forgotten. Here is this man Haman, and a shower of royal bounty is poured on the miserable beggar's head. And he's lifted up and up and up and up and promoted and promoted and promoted until he's a prince of the whole realm, and the fellow's an absolute rotter. And here is Mordecai, a good man who had saved the king's life, and he's unrewarded. How can you account for it? There's only one way to account for it, folks, and that is the overruling providence of God and divine purposes behind this man's life. Learn this and let me learn it. God not only works his will through what people do. God works his will through what people don't do. You think God will work his will whenever she does this and he does that and my mother does that or my father does that or my boss does this or the matron does that or the professor does this or the other. And when somebody does something, then God will work through what they do in my life. my friend, God will also work through what they abstain from doing. And He'll employ what they abstain from doing for the very same purpose as He can use what they do. And you say, why doesn't she do this? And why doesn't he do that? And why don't the other group do the other? So that we can get on with this that we feel God would have us do. My friend, do not berate God because they don't do things. And you think God is being slow in helping you. God can also help you by what they don't do. Now think about this. Had Mordecai been rewarded for that very kind act at the beginning of this wonderful story, there would have been no opportunity for the wickedness of this enemy of God's people and the horrible nature that he had to be revealed to the king. He'd never have found out. And the danger to the people of God would never have been exposed if Mordecai had been lifted up and got number one position in the land as a prince early in the story. Had Mordecai already been promoted, Haman wouldn't have sought his ruin. But the delay, and Haman is insulted by Mordecai not bowing down before him, is used by God to bring Mordecai to the brink of ruin. From the wrath of this haughty favorite of the king's. He is brought, it is a tremendous story of God's brinkmanship. He brings this man almost to the gallows. The shadow of the gallows are over his good head. And all the time he's bringing him through the pressure and bringing him through the trial, he's doing it, he's using every single iota of a step to be a blessing to all of the people of God. The rewarding of Mordecai has exactly one day to surface when you come into chapter 6. Or he's a dead man. One day. Either God moves within the next 24 hours, or he's dead. One day. This man is already planning to come and ask the king in the morning for Mordecai's neck. What miracle is going to deliver this man of God? No miracle at all. There aren't any miracles in the book of Esther. God is going to use a very ordinary human experience to turn history. And you're sitting here tonight, and maybe you're waiting for a miracle. And everything seems lost. God may not use a miracle. He may use a very ordinary experience to change your entire life. Don't always think that God will use a miracle. Will the thunder fall and kill the king? No. Will the lightning hit him? No. Will the earth swallow all these fellas up? No. It's happened before, but it won't happen here. Will an angel come and whip him away and hide him from his pursuers? No. God will save him by his providence through an ordinary human experience. He'll have life and he'll have glory and he'll have prominence within his nation without a miracle. And I want us all to learn this, and I want my heart to learn this in these days. So many young people going through difficult times who are believers and older friends, and they say, look, you know, maybe some of these other guys have a magic way to God, and some magic thing they pray about, some kind of right phraseology, but I don't seem to find it. My life seems very mundane and very ordinary and very real. And there's no miracle in it. And I can't tell about any great, thrilling experiences that I have had in my Christian life in the last 6 months. I have had nothing, you say, but pressure and difficulty, and the more I try to put God first, the worse it seems to become, just like this fellow. It's a wonderful story for ordinary folk like you and me. Although, really, honestly, there is no such thing as an ordinary person in that sense. Everybody is special. But in a common experience, we're not claiming to be anything, are we? Here in this city of trouble and sorrow and difficulty, what are we looking for? Well, we're looking for the goodness of God, not always through a miracle, but sometimes through an ordinary, everyday experience. Tell me now, here is the king, and he's in his palace. And will God send some friend of the people of God to get down on their knees and plead with him at this time? No. Will somebody lobby him? A group of people go and lobby him in court? No. And bring it about? No. Forgive the expression, but would there be a local press campaign start to move this black-hearted man? No. Where in the world would you find somebody to remind the king of his obligation to his wife's nation not to wipe them out, men, women, and children, on one day? Maybe I stand here tonight and I look into the face of a modern-day Mordecai. A woman or a man, perhaps, who has been overlooked. Then learn from this story. Let me, my dear overlooked one, and you've sought to put God first, and you've sought to live for Him, but you haven't been promoted in your job, and you haven't been moved on, and lots of fellas and girls have got lots of other things, and you say, why did they have it, Lord, and I'm trying to live for you, and I have all of this? Let me remind you, faithful Christian, as you have sought to put the Lord first, God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love which you have shown toward His name. Others haven't even seen it, but He has. When you do, said the Savior, a charitable deed, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. It's a promise. Now Jesus sat opposite the treasury and saw how the people put money into the treasury, and many who were rich put in much. Then one poor widow came and threw in two mites. So he called his disciples to him and said, assuredly, I say to you that this poor widow who has put in more than all those who have gone given to the treasury, for they put in out of their abundance, but she out of her poverty put in all that she had, her whole livelihood. And nobody noticed the two mites except God. God is not distant from you. God is not indifferent to you. Christian, you are never out of God's watchful eye, and you are never far from God's protective care. What did God do? Well, the deliverance of the Jews and the rewarding of Mordecai was precipitated by something as insignificant as insomnia. See the situation. The king lies down, can't sleep. Now, what could be more ordinary than that? All of us have those experiences. And I'll tell you something, folks. He won't sleep until he hears about Mordecai. You say, how? Well, it's amazing the detail that is given in this passage. That night, well, what other night? The guy has got one day to live. That night, says verse 1, the king couldn't sleep. So one was... Now, what could be more ordinary than that? All of us have those experiences. And I'll tell you something, folks. He won't sleep until he hears about Mordecai. You say, how? Well, it's amazing the detail that is given in this passage. That night, well, what other night? The guy has got one day to live. That night, says verse 1, the king couldn't sleep. So one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the chronicles, and they were read before the king, and it was found that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Then the king said, "What honor or dignity has been stowed on Mordecai for this?" And the king's servants who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." Now notice the emphasis. That night, sleep wouldn't come. See, I love this truth of God's brinkmanship. I mean, you take a girl like Ruth, who lost her husband, probably in the first year of marriage. She has no child, she has no husband. Her sister wants to stay back in the land of Moab. But while Orpha leaves her mother-in-law, Ruth cleaves to her mother-in-law. By a kind act, she is kind to those around her, even though her heart is breaking with the bereavement, and she holds closely to her mother-in-law. And she says, "Your people will be my people. And your God, my God. Where you die, I'll die." And then she goes to the land of Egypt and she is given the most menial task any girl could have. Gleaning corn. They were only allowed to pick up what these guys dropped by mistake, or the corners that were left for the poor at the field. They weren't allowed to cut the corner. The corner and the bits they left behind. These girls were so hungry for their families, they were allowed to follow the reapers. And if anything fell by mistake, and you can imagine, they're just like our cat that was at the table tonight, you know, just looking up at you, waiting for anybody to drop or anything. That dog of yours at home that watches your every move. "Will your heart be hard tonight," he says in his eyes, waiting just for something. And of course, what would happen? They dealt with them like some people deal with a cat or the dog. They cursed them. I didn't curse the cat, by the way. But they cursed them, these men cursed these girls when they came too close to gather this corn. Cursed them. It was a very menial task. Yet I read in Scripture, and it happened that Ruth turned into a field that belonged to Boaz. She didn't know she was going into a field of a wealthy man, and that she was going to marry him, and that from her womb would come a child whose child would be King David, and King David's greater son would be the little baby led in Bethlehem's manger. Who would have thought that a girl who wasn't even a Jew from a heathen nation, by going to glean in a field in the darkest day in her life, in her bereavement, absolutely heartbroken, gleaning corn in a field, and even the boss who eventually married her had to say to his men, "Leave her alone. Don't say anything to her. Leave her. And let her come and have water when she needs it. Care for her." Who would have thought that was going to be the outcome? And you know, when eventually the story comes, there comes that famous verse in Ruth where her mother-in-law has to say to her, "Look, Ruth, would you stop pacing the floor? Sit still, my daughter, to see how the matter will fall. For he shall not be in rest this day because of thee." And Boaz speaks of our heavenly Boaz. I say to you girls, and I say to you fellas tonight, in all of your circumstances, and I don't know what they all are, would you sit still and quit panicking? Every single major story in the Scriptures begins with a tragedy. Moses murdered somebody. Paul was a murdering bigot. Peter was a bad-tempered, foul-mouthed fisherman. Look at them. Story after story after story of men and women who were in the deepest, darkest hole of their lives, the Josephs of this world. Do you think if you'd have said, "How are you getting on in that hole, Joseph?" he'd have said, "It's great. Pass me down a copy of Always Praising. I'm enjoying it. I'm going to become governor of Egypt. I'm going to save a nation. It's wonderful in this hole." Of course not. How many of you are in holes tonight of one kind or another, in caves and dens of circumstances? And I'm here to tell you, when you think everything's lost, it isn't. It isn't. It's so important that you and I learn that. And when you think that nobody notices, nobody cares, nobody ultimately cares, I'm here to tell you, you're wrong. God does. A momentous event like this hung on such a slender thread as a king who couldn't sleep. I mean, the thing seems ridiculously ordinary. Sleep wouldn't come. You would think that sleep would come to a king who had probably feasted far more than some poor peasant down there in a cottage somewhere in his realm who hadn't anything to eat. But I tell you, the poor were sleeping soundly in their beds that night while the king couldn't sleep on his bed. Why, amid all of his luxuries, did sleep happen to leave the couch of His Majesty at such a critical moment? I'll tell you why. Because God drove sleep away from him that night. Learn it in life. Let me learn it in life. To trace God's hand in the most trivial events. Christian, there is nothing fortuitous in your life. Nothing just that you say, just fortune sent it to me. Fortune did not send it to you. You and I cannot say that things are fortuitous in our life, fortuitous in our lives. Why? Because it's nothing but God. You and I, who love the Lord and know the Lord and we wish we loved Him more and knew Him better, we must not go around just thinking that our faith is just inside meetings and just when we're singing and studying the Bible and going to church gatherings. Our God is with even how a person sleeps or doesn't sleep. History can hang upon insomnia. I have found that the biggest things that have happened to me in my life have been crossing a street, bumping into a person, a telephone call, a magazine article, something in the corner of a newspaper, something somebody said, the most seemingly insignificant thing, some little tiny hinge upon which a great door in my life swung. Would you think of ascribing to God something so seemingly unimportant as a king who couldn't sleep? But when you think about it in depth, the fact that this king didn't sleep is an essential link in the chain of events in this amazing book. It's actually one of the kingpins in the story. You take it out and the rest all collapses. It's useless. Another night, and Mordecai would have been in his grave. Says the word of God, that night the king could not sleep. There is nothing casual to God. Nothing casual. You know how we say, oh, come and dress casual, be relaxed. I want to tell you, there is nothing, absolutely nothing, that is casual about God or to God. In Him we live. In Him we move. In Him we have our being. Stephen Hawking, the professor of mathematics at Cambridge University, says the world runs according to the law of physics. There is no God, he says. But the Bible brings God before us, not just merely as a law upon which the world turns, but a God before us that everything occurs under His sovereignty. The Bible says that He even feeds ravens. He sees sparrows fall. You know, Epicurus removed his gods to a distance from the earth that they might feast without disturbance from the tumults of people. These gods, small g, didn't interrupt their festivities with the government of the world. Is this God of the Bible a God who is away out there and doesn't care? That's not what chapter 6 of this book teaches. That's not the God of the Bible. God's providence is as necessary for a microscopic insect to lift one of its tiny feet as it is for the regulating of the very motions of the solar system. You ever watched a little tiny creature go across a page of paper in front of you, you know, a little tiny microscopic thing going, and you say, my goodness, it lives and breathes and has life. And you couldn't have it in your heart to smudge them out. And you blow them off. Because the rest of your day would be hurt if you'd killed them. Because he's a miracle even to be alive at that size. And you say, I wonder what it's like down there, fella. We've all thought like that. It's important. Why then, when sleep fled the king, did he not say, bring me in the orchestra? And of course, the plain fact is, he could have had anything in the wide world that was possible to have to put a man to sleep at the snap of his fingers. And what did he call for? What did he call for? Why could nothing amuse the king but a history book? Henry Ford said that history is bunk. So he made cars and made history. But is it? Not to the king. He said, go get me some history books. I wonder how many of you will put yourselves to sleep tonight with, say, the fall and rise of the Roman Empire by Gibbon. I'll not ask for a straw poll, but how many of you loved history at school and still read those books avidly? I know Princess Diana reads Danielle Steele. Interesting thing is, her butler is a believer and never goes anywhere without his Bible. I wonder what they talk about. But she talks about how she reads Danielle Steele. Well, Danielle Steele would be a fair crack of a distance from history for a king. Do you think a history book would induce sleep? Oh, it's incredible. bring me, he says, the chronicles of this nation. You can see these guys coming in with these books. In the middle of the night, is this man out of his mind? What do you want us to do, sir? Read them to me. Oh, what a lullaby. And he killed so-and-so, and he killed so-and-so, and then the army did this, and with so many pounds of, I was going to say, Brussels sprouts, and so many potatoes, and with this and that and the other. Facts! Mere historical facts! I said to a policeman friend of mine, I said, Dad, do you think that would induce sleep? When I was talking to him about this passage today, I said, do you think you could go down to the RUC and get out the archives, into the archives, and get all the chronicles of crime and whatever? Do you think that would put you asleep tonight? We're liable to keep you awake. And then let me ask you in God's presence, why did he choose history books? I've never heard of anybody else doing this before as such. Why, out of the millions and millions of thoughts that he had, did it strike him to read a history book? Maybe he thought they'd be so boring they would put him asleep. But even if that were his motivation, why did he think to make it a history book? And I'll tell you something, the thought was the king's. But those thoughts were the instruments of God. And tell me then, when he's going through all of these history books, what induced him for his eye or finger to fall, or the reader's finger to fall upon the proper place? It's a pretty big subject, the Chronicles of the Persian Empire. I think I saw a book the other day, was it being published, or articles published by The Guardian or something? I think it was The Guardian newspaper said it's going to publish the first 60 days of the Gulf Crisis. Goodness. We've only been in an area, Iran and Persia and around there in this crisis for about 60 days, and people are already trying to chronicle it. Imagine history that goes back hundreds of years. What probability is there that the reader would happen on a few lines that record Mordecai, who saved the king's life? He might have read until the morning, with ever coming across Mordecai, what finger guided him to that story? It was the finger of God that pointed to the record of Mordecai's service. The book of Esther is a book of wonders without a miracle. I mean, David Putman went in one day to a library, a local library, I think I remember right, and he was looking through some facts. And his eye fell on what? Two lines, which said that a Scotsman called Eric Little didn't run on a Sunday in the Olympic Games of whatever, 1930, whatever it was. And he thought, that's interesting, why did he not run? And it said Little didn't run because of religious convictions. You think of Eric Little, who read the Sermon on the Mount every single day, and turned, what was it, by the Japanese or the Chinese, died, if I remember right, of a brain hemorrhage in a prison camp. And when Sally Magnuson, Magnus's daughter, went to write a book on him called The Flying Scotsman, she went to some of the men who had lived with him, and they detested everybody in the camp, including missionaries and all kinds of people, and Sally Magnuson said, I couldn't find anybody anywhere in the world who would say a word against Little. Even the people who were in the camp with him. He so lived what the Sermon on the Mount is all about. And he died in total obscurity, forgotten, in a prison camp. And he wouldn't run on a Sunday because that was his conviction. But when the kids were getting up to sexual behavior that was immoral on Sunday afternoons in the camp, many of the children of the parents in that camp, they were so bored, they were getting involved in immorality. And what did Little do? The guy who wouldn't run to get a medal because of that particular conviction organized football matches on a Sunday afternoon. Always remember that fact. And who would ever have dreamt that it would become one of the greatest films of all time? I know, Christian, you look into my face and say, you're a romantic. How could I be anything else with a God like this? Who can take a little baby lying in a tiny little crib, floating down a river, painted with pitch, and bring Pharaoh's daughter down at that particular moment, finds the baby, and the baby starts to cry. What do most people do when a baby cries? Oh, give it a bottle. Oh, get it out of the restaurant. Oh, whatever. Just get it stopped. But what did she do? She called an Egyptian girl over, you see, and said, now I'd like somebody to nurse this for me. She said, sure, I'll get you somebody. And she went for her mother or whatever. Moses' sister Miriam looks after the baby. What an incredible story that the entire history of Egypt would hang on whether a baby cried or not. Next time a baby cries, a nation could hang on it, so don't be too hard on it. On baby's tears, you know, I find the thing mind-bending. On a baby's cry, a nation is saved. And you say, sure, what's about that? There are millions of tears shed every day. What I'm trying to say to you is, your God cares about all the details. So the king discovers this little story, a line or two, about this Jew who had saved his life from these two assassins. And of course the passage says, very simply, the king said, what honor, verse 3, or dignity has been stowed on him for this? And the king's servants who attended him said nothing. The king said nothing. Who's in court? Now, says the Bible, verse 4, and it's some now, isn't it? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. Folks, look at it. The guy is coming through the door to ask for the neck of Mordecai. And the king says, who is in the court, and they say, Haman, and he looks around, and he says to him, he says, very strange thing, he says, Haman, he says, come on in here, he says, what would you do to the man whom the king would delight to honor? Don't you think there's a tremendous lesson here? Don't you admire Mordecai during the time of his great neglect? Don't you? I want you to notice that this moment that comes where the guy's coming to have him hung and the man is coming to have him saved is all precipitated particularly by the way that Mordecai behaved in the meantime. Whenever he wasn't promoted, whenever nobody noticed him, when his heart was breaking, when everything was collapsing around him, notice that he never cajoled anybody, he never pushed anybody, he never shoved anybody. He never, ever wrote a letter to the king and said, you know, king, I saved your life and you never give me an honor. What did he do? He let God lift him. He worked for the good of the Lord's people. And he worked for the... Of course, he loved Esther, whom he had raised. Because she was an orphan. She'd lost her mom and dad, and he raised her. Notice that he was good to Esther. He looked after her when she was in there, and he worked for the good of the Lord's people and the greater glory of God. And he never lifted a finger and jumped up and down and said, I never got any promotion. I never got any medals. I never got nothing. Isn't that lovely? So if you're overlooked, and nobody's noticing, and nobody cares, My friend, don't get mad. And don't try and take things into your own hands. And try and shove circumstances to make them shake them and do them something. You go on with the legitimate duties that you have. And your God will see to it. You'll be promoted. Exceedingly above all that you ever asked or thought. And of course, Haman comes in and he says, what would I do for the man who the king delights to honor? And he thought in his heart, well, it's got to be me. I'm the only man he would want to honor, the big-headed beggar. And it got the better of him. Oh, he says, I know what you should do. You should have a robe that you wear, a robe of state, and give him a horse and put your crest on it, the royal crest, and set him up on it, and have one of your princes go in front of him and proclaim as he goes round the city square, this shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. And the king says, okay, certainly, no problem. Do it for Mordecai the Jew. You can almost hear his jaw hit the ground. Who? Who? Let me ask a few other little questions here. Why did the king not decide to confer the dignities on Mordecai himself? Why did he not immediately leave the matter to his servants? Say, go and honor that fellow. Why did Haman happen to come in at that moment? Why, when asking, did the king conceal the object of his royal favor? Why didn't he say, what would you do for Mordecai if I wanted to honor him? Why did the form of the question allow Haman to suppose that he was the man for whom the honors were intended? Every single detail of this wonderful story shows you the providence of God. What are you looking at, folks? You are looking tonight at a God who makes the greatest enemies of his people the means of advancing his interests. You got enemies? You got people ganging up on you, turning against you, criticizing you, pressurizing you, because of your stand for the Lord. My friend, don't panic. God can use that very enmity to bring about blessing. So what are you afraid of? Are you afraid of those people? Are you intimidated by them? I can see this man's imagination running riot. And then, of course, the very man champing to hang Mordecai is the one who's chosen to lead him round the city square. Boy, can you see it? What a moment. What a humiliation. Now, folks, let's get the other lesson here. Notice how Mordecai behaved when suddenly he was promoted. Notice he didn't say, I don't want any honors. I don't want any honors from the king. I'm the Lord's man. I'm not going to take any honors from a heathen king and an ungodly king. Why should I do that? I'm the Lord's servant. And I'm not going to take any silly old robe and any old crest and go around. Not at all. He honored sovereignty within his nation, as we should. He held it, not in stoical indifference, but with reverence and honor. He didn't spurn. When the king of the land wanted to place a favor upon him, he didn't spurn it. He didn't send a rude reply to the kindness of majesty. And notice that he didn't even affect to shun all earthly comfort. The man who had fasted and prayed in sackcloth and ashes for God's people, when he was offered this robe and this horse and a walk around the city square, he didn't say, don't be ridiculous. If that's what the king wanted, he went with it. And then when all this lauding had settled, notice in verse 10 what he did. He went back to where he had come from and he sat at the king's gate. You know, a proud man wouldn't have gone back. Some people, when they are honored, you see, and lifted high in a nation, they forget their roots and where they come from. And it's terrible. I love Lord Tony Pandy's word whenever he was raised to the House of Lords. And somebody said, how do you feel now? Oh, he says, I'll be the same size in the bath. He went right back to the king's gate, his accustomed place, his accustomed work. He went right back to his friends, and he sat down there. He didn't say, oh, the king has honored me, king has honored me, and I'm no longer going back to where I came from and going on with the work that I did. My friend, if God has honors designed for you, then, of course, they will find you. Those who give them know your address. You don't need to let them know your address. Mordecai is saying, if they want to confer more honors on me, and I can tell you, there were more honors on the way. He was going to become the most famous man from India to Ethiopia. His greatness was going to hold a nation in a coming day. But the guy went right back humbly to his roots, and he's simply saying, they know my address, Mordecai, the king's gate. Lovely humility. And friends, you know, this book is not done with the wonders of providence. Even with all the good intentions of the king, how could the Jews have been preserved? As I told you, the edict was out and they were dead men and women. How could he repeal it? Well, we are told that what happened was that the news of the exalting of Mordecai, and of course Haman was, as we're going to see, meted out the punishment that Mordecai should have got, that he had planned for him. The story rocketed right across the nation, and the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. You say, could the Lord do that with me? Yes, he could. Your life could be godly. Your life in the midst of your trials could be with dignity and with trust in God as you go forward. And I tell you, brother or sister, tens of thousands of people could be blessed as a result by your very name. God has always done his greatest work through individuals. You and me. And we are now Ulster. We now live here. It's our day now. Other generations are gone. We're here now. Now is the moment. How are we going to be? How are we going to react? How are we going to behave? I'm sure that man who sat there at the king's gate and saw those gallows being erected to hang him never dreamt that I would stand on the other side of the world and teach a Bible class in this city of his every move. And who knows, in future generations, some of you sitting here tonight, that others will tell your story because of the lessons you learned from this. Haman goes home flaming in his heart with his head covered, and he tells the wife about it. This man, of course he doesn't know yet his fate, he says, this man, he says, has been honored that I wanted to hang. And you know, she says an amazing thing to him. If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you'll not prevail against him. You'll surely fall before him. Even his wife told him what was going to happen. She could see it coming in some form or other. Don't you think that's an echo of God's word to Abram? I'll make you a great nation. I'll bless you. I'll bless those who bless you. And I'll curse those who curse you. Friends, remember this. What goes around comes around. And don't you think there are echoes of this all around Europe? With the first Christian service being held yesterday in the Red Square in St. Basil's at the Kremlin. I've walked around that building, and I'll tell you, when I was there in the 60s, I never dreamt that day would come when they'd open the door and hold services. Who would have thought that the government that wouldn't allow Solzhenitsyn out to get his Nobel Prize for Literature, that the leader of it, Gorbachev, would come out and come to Oslo a few years later and receive the Prize for Peace. Who would have believed that communism would have so hopelessly collapsed? And we're now watching the dismantling of it in so many places, and the rise of the Christian church, and its power surging across Eastern Europe. Whereas I said the other day, and I was talking to one of the leaders of Operation Mobilization, who sits on the board of Operation Mobilization in Durham, he says, "Derek, our ship, Logos II, went into Leningrad just recently," he said, "and they said to the port authorities, 'Will you take money or we can give you Bibles to pay for our port fees?' And the port authorities said, 'You can pay for it in Bibles.'" You think they'd do that in Belfast? That which is obscure, you think of how many dear Christians have died. You think of thousands in Soviet labor camps, made to stand for 48 hours on end in the one place, hung upside down, thumb screw nails and all the rest of it put on them, and the hammering and the killing of God's people who longed for this day to come, who are now with the Lord, the martyrs of the church. And there the Church of Christ goes on. Oh, disheartened one, weary one, tired one, depressed one, when all seems lost, it isn't. If you are in Christ, even though the cruelty of your circumstances are impossible to understand, God can even use a sovereign not being able to sleep to save millions. So, watch the little things. Be careful about the little things in your life, because they lead to great things. When all seems lost, it isn't. When no one seems to notice, God does. When everything seems great to the enemies of God's people, it's not. And when nothing seems just, it is. Now, could we take another hour in it next week? I'd love to go through all that again. It's so good. But no, we'll move on to the next chapter. But I don't think we'll ever find greater principles than those in chapter 6. Go home and read it again before you sleep. Before you sleep. And take your notes with you and just get them into your mind and into your heart. And may the Lord encourage you.